Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Chapter 1. The End Begins.
Mr. Echo. Good morning, Mr. Echo. How are you today? Good morning, Mr. Echo. Won't you take my cane?
When a day that you happen to know is Wednesday starts off by sounding like Sunday, there is something seriously wrong somewhere. I felt that from the moment I woke. And yet, when I started functioning a little more sharply, I misgave. After all, the odds were that it was I who was wrong, and not everyone else, though I did not see how that could be. I went on waiting, tinged with doubt. But presently I had my first bit of objective evidence. A distant clock struck what sounded to me just like 8. I listened hard and suspiciously. Soon another clock began, on a loud, decisive note. In a leisurely fashion, it gave an indisputable 8. Then I knew things were awry.
It's quite good, this, that we found a book that doesn't just start on a specific date. It starts at a specific time.
Specific time on a specific day.
Yeah,
on
with
a specific
the clock ringing out. That bodes well.
It's curiously specific. Welcome to the Curiously Specific Book Club, the book club that is curiously specific about dates and locations in books. My name's Lloyd Shepherd. I'm a novelist and digital product manager, work for the likes of The Guardian and the BBC.
Hello, my name's Tim Wright. I'm a digital writer and producer, and I specialise in playing with new technologies to find new ways to tell stories.
Every episode, we like to take a book out for a walk into the wild to try and figure out exactly how specific it is about the dates and the locations in the story and how much the novelist is just making up.
So this week, we're going to specialise in a book called
The Day of the Triffids.
So it's a day, is it? The Day of the Triffids.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Not really, though, is it?
What is the day he's talking about?
The Day of the Triffids.
Well, there is a day. There is a date. We'll come on to that.
And that's what we're going to find out.
But our hero, Bill Mason, is lying in a hospital bed with bandages over his eyes. He takes the bandages off and realises that everyone else has gone blind.
Yeah, and even worse.
Everyone else has gone blind. I don't know what that was.
It's The Day of the Triffids.
By John Wyndham.
John Wyndham. Again, one of these books that I think people will think they know quite well from various films and TV series.
Yes, yeah, 1981, John Dettine.
Yeah, well, there's another one, but you just refuse to acknowledge that one.
That's the one with Dougray Scott, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, you're not having anything to do with that, are you?
I'm not touching that.
There is a film as well.
With a Howard Keel.
I didn't know
Oh,
that.
What a beautiful morning.
It's never a good idea when you sing on the podcast.
I love it. So we're starting in West London. We are going to move in towards London.
Well, I essentially think we're on the A4.
We're good, walking up the A4.
Pretty much.
Via Hyde Park Corner and Piccadilly.
And then Piccadilly.
We're going to end up in a pub in the West End.
Hooray!
But then we're going to go out of London. We're going to go back to the southeast where we were really walking.
West Sussex.
To a place called Pulborough.
Yes, we need to get out of the city. It's gone completely mad there. Everyone's looting.
Shooting each
other. There's disease.
People are dying from the plague.
It's disgusting.
And then there's these giant plants everywhere that have lifted themselves out of their beds and are stinging people to death.
Yeah, they seem to know their way into Piccadilly. Did you notice that?
Yeah,
they can get right into town.
They've all got Oyster cards. But first of all, we need to head straight out to West London and find this hospital. Health warning, it's quite noisy.
Why the founders of St Merin's Hospital chose to erect their institution at a main road crossing upon a valuable office site and thus expose their patients' nerves to constant laceration is a foible that I never properly understood. But for those fortunate enough to be suffering from complaints unaffected by the wear and tear of continuous traffic, it did have the advantage that one could lie abed and still not be out of touch, so to speak, with the flow of life. Customarily, the westbound buses... I'm looking at a pair of them now. Customarily, the westbound buses thundered along trying to beat the lights at the corner. As often as not, a pig squeal of brakes and a salvo of shots from the silencer would tell that they hadn't. Then the released cross traffic would rev and roar as it started up the incline.
So you have a problem with the word incline, don't you?
Well, should we explain where we are before we start talking about
No, let's have an argument right now.
Should we give the listener a little bit of context for the thing we're about to argue about? So we're Fair sat enough. In Hammersmith in West London. What road are we on?
We're on the Hammersmith Road.
On the Hammersmith Road. Mm. Why have you brought me here?
Well, to buy you a decaf latte.
So we're sat at a Starbucks next to a building.
Next to a building which is, I think, the headquarters of Sony Ericsson in the UK, or it was until before the pandemic. I don't know if it still is.
Okay.
And it used to be West London Hospital.
Okay.
Founded in 1856.
We have a lot of found sound in this location.
Well,
which is rather confirming Bill Mason's in the spirit, description.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying to you. Already, my point is being made. If you want to find the noisiest hospital in West London,
yeah, this is quite
you're looking at it. Hammersmith is sort of out of the west of London.
It's about 5 miles, 6 miles from the centre of London, right?
Yeah, and it's quite near the river, although you wouldn't know it from the traffic.
It's very near the river, actually. Hammersmith
but
Bridge.
It was completely sort of changed by the Hammersmith flyover.
Yeah.
So most people A4. Don't even stay in Hammersmith. The A4 goes over the top of it. And obviously the bit in the middle where the tube station is a highly developed set of office buildings now.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it used to be the headquarters of Disney, actually.
Up in the 80s and 90s, isn't they?
Yeah, so it's a very developed space.
Yeah.
Well, he says he chose to erect their institution at a main road crossing upon a valuable office site.
Yeah.
So,
It's good so far.
I like it. It says in 1925... there was a new wing opened by Princess Mary. This had an accident ward of 16 beds, cancer wards, each of 7 beds for male and female patients. And here's the thing, 26 rooms for private patients and 2 operating theatres. So he's a private patient, isn't he, Bill Mason?
He's quite keen to tell you that as
right?
well.
And they were charged 5 guineas a week for a single room.
Trifid business is good. Trifid farming business is good.
Yeah.
Well, the other reason I suppose you would say this works is, later on it says, it pointed out that there was not even the distant hum of traffic, not the whistle of a train, nor the hoot of a tugboat.
Yes.
And the other reason this place works quite well for that is we're very close to the train line.
Yep.
And just beyond it is the river.
Is the river. Yeah.
Right. I'm slightly worried now that this might be quite good.
Yeah. So then the other thing is, of course, then we've got to think about his... First of all, there have to be 5 floors because one of the doctors throws himself out of a window. There were 5 floors.
Oh, there were?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So that's all right. But then when he leaves by a side entrance into a yard.
Yeah.
And opposite is a pub called the Alamein
Arms. The Alamein
Arms.
Yes.
Problem.
No pub there. There's no pub called
Well, I can't find any pubs on either of the side roads that to the
right.
hospital. There's some other reasons why I love this hospital.
Okay.
One of them is that several episodes of The Sweeney were filmed in this hospital.
I can't give you that then.
I found a really great article on theartsdesk.com called Unforgettable, The Sweeney by Thomas H. Green. It was quickly clear everyone had a brilliant time making the series, except perhaps Thor's wife, Sheila Hancock, who admitted tearing him off a strip when he perennially returned late from the set, and as often, the pub. The pub. Mm-hmm. Stories were told, too, that drew attention to the show's bawdy male culture, with Linda Bellingham recalling the weekly parties at the seedy Red Cow pub in deepest West London, where strippers were a fixture. You are going to like the Red Cow.
Right.
You look at your little face, you don't like it now.
No.
Any minute now, you're going to love it.
Okay.
Now, there is no Alamein Arms pub
right.
down the side.
Yeah.
But this Red Cow pub
yeah.
is quite a good candidate for a pub that you'd want to go into without the strippers.
Without the strippers.
Because on a Facebook page called Venues We Have Rocked, the Red Cow, 157 Hammersmith Road.
Right, which is that...
It's just down here,
just down
it's
there,
just
yeah.
a bit further. He would have walked past it, Bill Mason, on his way into London. He
yeah.
would have gone past the Red Cow. So, no to the Alamein Arms,
yeah.
yes to the Red Cow. Jazz pub in the 50s, country music in the 60s, and then in 75, it became a rock venue. So Joe Strummer's 101ers were one of the first bands
oh, really?
To play there, and then a lot of punk bands, The Damned, and the first UK gig ever of AC/DC.
Oh, wow.
And I have found, this is why you're going to like
they
it.
They like strippers.
I have found a reminiscence here on loudersound.com of someone who attended that gig.
So it was like 74, 75, something like that.
It's a great little article by Malcolm Dome. What happened at AC/DC's first British gig on April the 23rd, 1976?
Okay.
The Red Cow was an unpretentious West London boozer cum venue. It was here that AC/DC played their first show outside Australia.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, right here. You're liking it more now, aren't you?
Only if Rush was supporting.
As was standard, the band played two sets with a brief interlude in between. Before the first set, their prospects looked... Oh. Ambulance.
Yeah.
Before the first set, their prospects looked unpromising. Barely 30 people were in the back room, a mix of fledgling punks, student types, and the odd long hair. Nobody knew what to expect. Angus was instantly the focus of attention. Word was out that he was dressed as a schoolboy. The set was short, just 7 songs. Afterwards, Bon came to the bar, chatting to a few of us who had hung around. He even bought everyone a drink.
Good
or rather,
man.
Got them gratis from the barman. And then he disappeared with 2 girls.
Of course he did.
Second set, word got around, the place was packed. By the end, any worries about Britain being a tough nut to crack had evaporated. Such a flying start gave the band a huge injection of confidence. Later that month, they embarked on the legendary Lock Up Your Daughter's Pub Tour. Complete with nightly Angus lookalike competitions. You would have loved this.
But after one gig?
The nation, Britain went crazy for them. They spent most of 76 on the road, and they ended up being so popular, they booked the Lyceum Ballroom in London for their final gig of the tour.
This is also near here.
Yeah, they snowballed. Snowballed, mate. Look, I've got the AC/DC Red...
So this is a rock, this is a rock heartland here.
Yeah, AC/DC Red Cow list, set list.
Go on.
Live Wire.
I'm a Live Wire! Live Wire!
She's got balls.
She's got balls.
It's a long way to the top.
It's a long way to the top if you wanna rock and roll. I am Bon Scott.
Soul Stripper.
Don't know that one.
Can I sit next to you,
Can
girl?
Can I sit next to you, girl?
The Jack.
She's got the Jack!
High Voltage.
High Voltage Rock and Roll.
TNT.
TNT. She's dynamite!
You're just making it up now.
No, I'm not. These are all real.
Baby, Please Don't Go.
That's a cover, don't it?
Yeah, they must have done that as their closer.
Yeah.
Well done.
I'm quite
You see, you had a look of disdain when I started talking about this.
I'm happy now.
And now I found you a pub.
Nothing in life can't be improved with the addition of AC/DC.
Right. So you like this hospital now, don't you?
I do. I still don't think it's the right one.
Damn it.
So, talk a little bit about the book itself.
Yes.
Published in 1951.
Yep.
He started writing it, I believe, there's a very good BBC 4 documentary about him, which you can see on YouTube, that says he started writing it on Valentine's Day 1949.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Obviously not doing a lot on Valentine's Day then.
Yeah. But the book was published, first of all, it was serialised in 5 parts in Collier's magazine. And from that point on, Wyndham was famous. It was an instant hit.
Before it was a book?
at the same time, in the same year.
Oh, okay. He did write a lot for magazines before he became a novelist.
Yeah, so let's talk about John Wyndham, because he's an interesting figure. Born in 1903, eldest son of a barrister. His parents separated when he was 8, spectacularly. And then he went to a series of schools, at the end of which he went to Beedale's, which we'll come on to.
I've been to Beedale's. Yeah. That doesn't surprise you, does it?
I always think that I'm collaborating in the choice of these books, yet they always seem to end up talking about a private school somewhere, and then we always end up talking about Gresham's in Norfolk.
I think that tells you more about the British publishing industry up till about up to the present day, frankly, than it does about me.
I think it says something about you as well. But yes,
agreed. I helped Jeremy Paxman take a trunk up the stairs in Beedale's.
Did you?
Yeah.
It was twinned with my school, Beedale's.
Ah, but you weren't invited there, presumably.
I was never invited there, but we shared our exam papers.
You had special exams?
Special exams.
So in what way were they different to normal exams? Well, so you'd have different topics, like...
Beedale's and the school I went to like to think of itself as progressive.
So I think it tells you everything you need to know that Daniel Day-Lewis and Jay Jagger went there.
Right. Well, Daniel Day-Lewis went to Beedale's and my school, because I think he was kicked out.
It's a rock and roll school.
It is a rock and roll school. My school wasn't. So, yeah, so he came out of school in 1921, tried a number of different careers.
He tried to be a farmer, didn't he?
He tried to be a farmer. He worked in advertising. He did a bit of law study, but he did have a bit of a private income.
Yes.
And that sort of stopped him kind of committing to anything. And he took to writing short stories.
For mainly American sci-fi mags.
Yeah, Wonder Stories and Amazing Stories.
There's a really great site called galacticjourney.org.
Oh, nice.
Which blogs about science fiction, fantasy stuff, and has lots of great covers of these magazines. Fantastic Adventures magazine, and as you say, Amazing Stories. And some of them have his stories in them, but he was writing as John Bainan at that point.
John Bainan Harris.
Yeah, or just John Bainan in some cases.
So Bainan was...
This one, The Menace of the Metal Men by John Bainan.
Yeah, so Bainan was his middle name. His full name was John Wyndham Parks Lucas Bainan Harris.
Oh,
yeah. So, you know.
Harris.
So his career wasn't really going anywhere. It was doing all right.
Meanwhile, he's holed up in a gentleman's club, right?
Yeah, so he moved into the Penn Club pretty soon after he left Beedale's, actually. But the Penn Club opened in 1920.
Yeah.
And it was formed by the Friends Ambulance Society.
Aren't they Quakers?
Well, they had a big Quaker aspect. I don't think it was formerly a Quaker place. But he basically lived there for the next 40 years, right? I mean, it was like, you know, it's in Bloomsbury. It's shut down, isn't it? Didn't it go out of business?
Do you know COVID did for it? Last year, it shut down. That's what COVID did for it.
It's a real shame. Yeah. But he was living there, and there he met a woman.
They had women in this club, yeah.
He met a woman called Grace Wilson. She was a teacher in Greenwich. And they had neighbouring rooms.
Hey!
And they didn't get married because she didn't... If they'd married, she would have had to give up her job.
Oh, yeah. Due
to some weird kind of, you know, marriage law.
Well, until the Second World War, that was true, yeah.
And she didn't want to give up her job. So they basically conducted... I don't think it was a platonic affair, but, you know, a secret affair. People didn't know about it. And they carried that on for decades... And didn't get married until 1963.
That's when she retired.
When she retired.
So that she'd had her career.
And they retired to a house
where?
In Steep.
Yeah.
Which is where Beedale's is. Right.
So he went from Beedale's. To the Penn Club. Couple of years finding himself, then just decided to go to the Penn Club.
Which is kind of like
lived in the Penn Club.
Kind of like a school for grown-ups, right?
Yeah. Met Grace.
Yeah.
And then went back to Beedale's.
Yeah. And by all accounts, he was a very private, secretive... Maybe a bit weird, kind of. Weird's probably a bit unfair, but, you know, maybe not.
I think you're being a bit normative.
Okay.
How dare you?
I was, yes, you're probably right.
What strikes me is that he didn't write novels, and then his brother, who he's very close to, because
his younger brother
went to Beedale's as well.
Vivian Bainan Harris.
Yeah. That his brother got a book deal after the war.
Yeah, he published four novels between 1948 and 1951.
Having not really been much of a writer till then. So that must have tweaked his nose a bit, don't you think? And he decided that, well, if he can be a novelist, surely I can be a novelist. So he brought out one of his story ideas and worked it up into a novel, and it was immediately successful. Well, he was driven by his brother, but then... And then because of his success, obviously they demand another and another. But if you think about it, he basically wrote intensely, novels intensely, for about 10 years. So he's nearly 50 when Day of the Triffids is published. So he's quite an old guy to be talking about the new world, don't you think?
Well, he was also still very unsure of himself. There's an extraordinary story in the late 50s, maybe early 60s, where he submitted a manuscript under the pseudonym of, I think, Lucas Bainan or Lucas Parks, which is his middle name. But he submitted a book that was a collaboration between John Wyndham and Lucas Parks. And then when people said, well, who's Lucas Parks? He was like, well, it's me. I mean, that just indicates a slight lack of confidence.
I guess so. Eventually, people are going to work out that Tim Wright is just another version of Lloyd Shepherd, though, aren't they?
I don't really know where to go with that.
I know where we should go. I know where we should go.
Where we should go.
The Groping City. I left the pub door swinging behind me as I made my way to the corner of the main road. There, I hesitated. To the left, through miles of suburban streets, lay the open country. To the right, the West End of London, with the city beyond. I stood there indecisively for a few minutes, then I turned east, Londonwards.
So
we've been walking down the Brompton Road, haven't we?
We've been looking for another hospital.
Yeah, what was that about?
Well, I was theoretically sceptical of your West London.
When you say theoretical, you were instinctively sceptical. You just didn't want to agree with me.
No, I was feeling quite antsy about it. And then I obviously liked the Red Cow anecdotes.
Yeah, so then you took me to another hospital.
So we went to the Princess Beatrice Hospital, which is on the corner of Old Brompton Road and Fimber Road in, I guess, part of town I guess you'd call Brompton. So east of Hammersmith, between Hammersmith and London, further in towards London. The Princess Beatrice opened in 1887.
Well, there's an ambulance just to prove it.
Yeah, there's an ambulance just to prove it. And sort of grew over the years. By 1951, it had six stories with accommodation for private patients on the second floor.
Okay.
Kind of, the basis of private patients. Now, things we liked about it, the doctor in the first chapter rather peremptorily just throws himself out of the window on the fifth floor.
Good God, man, I'm blind.
Good God, man, I'm blind. I must kill myself.
Yeah.
And there was quite a good throwing yourself out of the window on the fifth floor.
Oh, very spectacular.
He talks about it being in the West Wing in the book, and Princess Beatrice didn't really have a West Wing. So that was pretty good. Had a good entrance with steps up to it, also very good.
I'm loving all these alarms, by the way.
They're good, aren't they? And then things that were wrong with it. Yep. Well, actually, there's one other thing that I like about the Princess Beatrice Hospital. Which I need to tell you. It was the hospital in American Werewolf in London.
Oh, was it?
Yeah.
Oh, hold on a minute. That's Jenny Agutter as a nurse.
Jenny Agutter as a nurse.
She was a nurse in that hospital.
She was a nurse in that hospital.
All right, I'm coming around to your way of thinking.
So, you know, quite like that about it. The big things counting against it were, there's a churchyard behind it.
You'd mention that, wouldn't you?
Which you would mention, right? You'd surely mention the churchyard.
The doctor's office is on the fifth floor of the West Wing.
Yeah.
And the West Wing would be where the graveyard is.
Where the churchyard is now, says that.
Yeah, so that's
so
not so good, is
I'm
it?
I'm not so keen on the Princess Beatrice.
There was a pub, though.
There was a pub. We went looking for a pub nearby.
Oh, they're going round and round.
Yeah. But yeah, the pub was quite... It was a Pembroke, called the Pembroke, formerly the Colhern Arms.
The Colhern Arms.
So I quite like the Red Cow, but you had a... You have found some stuff about the Colhern Arms.
Well, in the same way that you would be strangely drawn to Red Cow because of your AC/DC fetish.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The Colhern Arms feels more like my kind of place. Yeah. It was a well-known gay pub.
Right.
Even in the 1930s, they had drag entertainers. I'm looking at the Wikipedia page for this pub, by the way.
I can't imagine John Wyndham.
They had drag entertainers at lunchtime.
Really? In the 1930s?
Yeah. Do you think John Wyndham went for that? He might do, you know.
Well, he might have done.
Just because he got married doesn't mean anything.
Quite a repressed individual, I would say.
Yeah, it became a gay pub in the mid-50s.
Yeah.
Originally, it was segregated into two bars, one for the straight crowd and one for the gay community.
Are you reading out a cinema ad for it?
Yes.
We've got two bars.
In the 1970s, it became a notorious leather bar. Come visit our leather bar, just next to the cinema.
Is leather bar an accepted sort of description of a... Does a leather bar mean a bar you go to wearing leather?
Oh, come on now.
Or a bar that...
Oh, you haven't really... You've lived a very secluded life,
haven't you?
Does it mean
an upholstered bar?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's what it means. Yeah. Shall I tell you who used to hang out there?
Go on.
Freddie Mercury.
Well.
Kenny Everett.
Kenny Everett.
Anthony Perkins.
Anthony Perkins.
Rupert Everett.
Rupert Everett, he must have been about 15.
Ian McKellen and Derek Jarman are all hanging out there. And then, curiously, the South African swing bowler Mike Proctor.
Well, swing bowlers.
He seems the odd one out in that list. But I would have enjoyed it there. It would have been fun. It was nicknamed the Clone Hearn.
I don't think I've ever seen you.
Because everybody dressed the same.
I've never seen your leatherwear.
No, but I'd like people like that. I like the atmosphere in places like that.
You find it culturally interesting?
Well, they're usually very interesting people.
You're such a tourist.
Yeah, I am actually. That's probably right.
I've got a couple of other hospitals it could have been.
Yeah.
St Stephen's Hospital on 369 Fulham Road, demolished 1989. Now the Chelsea and Westminster, so a very modern hospital. I quite like it because it's big and it had lots of floors, but it's not on a corner. It's not on a corner, so it's no. You can't get the buses going north and south and east and west.
I'm barely listening to this now. Because
and then the other one could have been the Royal Brompton on Fulham Road.
Because it is the West London Hospital.
Oh, look, it's the Coldstream Guards.
I think that's so one for me there.
Yeah, all right, okay.
Anyway, don't try and distract them with the Coldstream Guards.
I'm giving you this one.
Okay.
With enormous reluctance.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to the Curiously Specific Book Club. If you'd like to listen to this podcast without any ads, head over to patreon.com and search for Curiously Specific and check out our membership tiers. You'll also get immediate access to any new episodes without having to wait a week.
You'll also get our show notes with lots of lovely links and videos and maps so you can start planning your own adventures.
So head over to patreon.com, search for Curiously Specific and check out our membership tiers. But for now, let's get back to the podcast.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to BOLLandBranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Even Hyde Park Corner, when I reached it, was almost deserted.
Okay.
A few derelict cars and lorries stood about on the roads. Very little, it seemed, had gone out of control when it was in motion. One bus had run across the path and come to rest in the Green Park. A runaway horse with shafts still attached to it lay beside the artillery memorial against which it had cracked its skull. The only moving things were a few men and a lesser number of women feeling their way carefully with hands and feet where there were railings and shuffling forward with protectively outstretched arms where there were not. Also, and rather unexpectedly, There were one or two cats, apparently intact visually, and treating the whole situation with that self-possession common to cats. They had poor luck prowling through the eerie quietness. The sparrows were few, and the pigeons had vanished.
Okay, well, I've got my camera out now, because look.
One of these horses needs to crack its skull on the artillery wall. They're just going past.
The Coldstream Guards.
If they were going to do it right.
Is it the Coldstream Guards? Are they a cavalry outfit? Obviously, it's not silent and quiet, right? It's very, very noisy
Super
and busy.
Noisy.
So, it's quite eerie thinking this would be silent, isn't it?
Yes. I know I keep banging on about this, but I'm just astounded with the idea that he thinks that within 24 hours of everyone going blind, society completely breaks down.
And it's not like everyone has gone blind, right?
It's crazy, right, that people are throwing themselves out of windows, smashing shop windows, fighting over food.
But isn't his point that, because he talks about the veneer of civilization, isn't his point that, you know, we're only one step away from
edge.
Anarchy and chaos, and if we don't keep a bloody lid on it, we're all going to go mad?
Well, you're coming around to my... Yeah, I was saying to you earlier about the pub. It's called the Alamein Arms.
Right.
In the book, right?
It is.
It's one of the few references to the Second World War in the book, even though it's written just after the Second World War.
Yeah.
I was suggesting to you that Alamein Arms is... You don't name pubs after Second World War incidents. It just doesn't happen. There's a very few of them.
I think you've not been able to find any, have you?
Well, there's Montgomery of Alamein in Warwickshire, but there's not... I mean, there isn't the Dunkirk, is there?
Right.
There isn't the Somme. Let's drink at the Somme.
That would be slightly strange.
It'd be quite weird, wouldn't it? But if you think about it, it's weird that there are quite a lot of Victorian war...
Well, is that because most pubs are Victorian?
But they change their name. They change their name.
Yeah, but don't they change their... when they're refitted in the sort of 80s and 90s, they change their name.
Yeah.
But if you were opening a pub up in the 90s, you wouldn't call it after Second World War.
Would you do
thing.
That in the 50s? Say, oh, let's open up the Alamein Arms.
I don't think pubs would be reopening in the 50s.
My point is that I think that he says that reference to Alamein because it's a bit of a joke.
It is a weird reference, isn't it?
It's a bit of a joke that anybody would do such a thing because, in his worldview, everyone's keeping a lid on it and not talking about the war.
Because he doesn't talk about the war. He talks about Hitler's war at one point.
Yeah. He was present at the D-Day landings, Wyndham.
He was.
So I suspect he did see some rather awful things. And like a lot of people who came back from the war, a lot of men who came back changed. Just didn't talk about it.
No.
And that maybe that's what we're getting about the whole thing, that we're only one step away from completely breaking down because... We've seen what.
Well, maybe
happens.
That's what's really going on with the Doctor. It's not his blindness at all. It's like he's brought back the war.
I think we should talk about 1951, about the year when this book appeared.
Yeah, a bit of context would be good, wouldn't it?
Just so you know the world that it lives in, as it were, or it emerged into.
Yeah.
I would say the most important thing about 1951 culturally is the Festival of Britain.
I would disagree.
What would you say?
Rocket 88. Was recorded in March by Ike Turner's Kings of Rhythm, the first rock and roll song put to record.
It's a very good point about music, I have to say, that I looked up 1951 in music and it was quite disappointing.
Yeah. Come on, Rocket 88? That's not disappointing.
Well, in the UK, there was... It's a world of Bing Crosby and Doris Day, basically, and Vera Lynn. And then a bit of Dixieland jazz like Chris Barber. I couldn't bear it.
This is why Rocket 88 is so important. But the other...
Did you know that's the first year that Lonnie Donegan performed Skiffle?
Is it?
Which is probably more important because that influenced everybody.
But like even John more important Beatles. Than either of those things, the Goon Show, first broadcast.
Ah, the Goons.
Yeah. There's quite a lot of nuclear stuff going on as well.
Yeah. I still think the Festival of Britain's like a big deal for the imagination of Wyndham and this story, mainly because if you go online and look at the promotional videos for the films at the time, they're really great, the movie tone stuff.
Yeah.
Lots of footage. And down in the South Bank alone in particular, there was an exhibition of... It's like the Great Exhibition 100 years later is meant to be. Down in South Bank, there's a science and technology fair going on with a telekinema and 3D cinema for the first time.
Yeah.
And lots of and a little mini rocket type thing going up, the Skylon. But then everybody walking around it is dressed like the Queen, you know, or the King, actually. The King opened it. So I think it's the last public event that King George attended before he popped his sword, actually. It's absolutely about the sweeping away of the old world, or the respecting the old world, I suppose, but respecting the fact that it's gone, and the greeting of
the new world of science and technology and atomic power and space. And then there's the anxiety bit in the middle of like, are we doing the right thing? Are these scientists good people? What's so bad about the old world? Isn't there something about the old world that's rather lovely? And that is John Wyndham's sweet spot, isn't it?
I think it is John Wyndham's sweet spot. But I mean, I think the anxiety you talk about, I mean, the Rosenberg trial begins in America.
Okay.
In April 1951.
Yeah.
So Rosenberg's obviously sold nuclear secrets to the Russians. Mm-hmm. So the spectre of a nuclear Russia is rising at this time. First thermonuclear device tested by the US in the Marshall Islands.
Here 1951. So science is coming, isn't it?
Science is coming.
The Mark I computer is released in Manchester at the university, the first commercial computer.
Oh, well, I had the first commercial computer program.
No, the Mark I computer was
run by Lyons Electronic Office.
Oh, yes, for managing tea rooms.
For managing tea rooms. I mean, that, you talk about
the logistics
the
of
old,
cake.
You talk about the old world and the new world.
Very important. We keep track of all the cakes.
How much tea are we putting in these cups? Surely we can reduce it.
Exactly.
The Treaty of San Francisco officially ended the Pacific War in 1951. And the US formally ended war with Germany.
Ah, I want to talk about that when we get to dates as
about
the end of the war. Great year for film. Really good year for film.
Yeah.
African Queen, Strangers on a Train, Streetcar Named Desire is that year.
Well, that is good. It's not a bad year for books either.
What books have you got then?
I've got The Cruel Sea, of course.
Oh, yes.
The Daughter of Time.
What's
Josephine
that?
Tay.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
That's a great book.
1951.
Yeah.
The End of the Affair.
Graham Greene.
Graham Greene, quite bleak.
Not a fan.
But the big ones for in terms of this one, we've got The Sands of Mars, which is Arthur C. Clarke's first novel, and Foundation.
Do you know they called Arthur C. Clarke the Man of 100 Hands? Because he's such a creepy guy.
They did.
Just so, you know.
They did.
But going back to films, I think culturally, again, there's something very interesting going on. First up, they introduced X rating. Well, there were X rated films for the first time ever. Yeah. But the one that I really like is The Day the Earth Stood Still.
They did. That is 1951, yeah.
Which is a fantastic film. I'm slightly worried, again, I'm going to go back to boarding school stuff, is that I'm assuming my prep school just got a load of 1951 films on a reel. They showed them to us
in
for like 3 years over and over
so
again.
So the day
as they were listing these films, I was thinking, these are all the films that I had to watch when I was 10. Gregory Peck was very busy that year. He was David in David and Bathsheba, and he was also Horatio Hornblower. Both of those were on my list. Lavender Hill Mob.
Oh, was that 51?
Yeah, that's 51. That's and The Man in the White Suit.
Yeah.
And it gives, so here's the thing. If you crossed The Day the Earth Stood Still with The Lavender Hill Mob, I think you'd get The World of John Wyndham. Don't you think?
Yeah, I think that's right.
I found a really great website from the Indiana University Cinema website about how Bernard Herrmann made The Earth Stand Still. If you don't know that film, it's basically about how an alien craft appears and a big, massive robot appears in the...
Clute.
And is here because human beings are becoming too violent and risking not just the peace on Earth, they're risking peace in the universe. But the soundtrack is really good.
I didn't realise it was Bernard Herrmann.
So Bernard Herrmann obviously is very famous.
Psycho.
Well, he did loads of Hitchcock. Yeah. Vertigo is a very good soundtrack as well. He wrote the theme scene to The Twilight Zone.
Very good. Yeah.
But here's the thing I said about his orchestration. He said, orchestration is the sine qua non of film music. Imagine Darth Vader appearing on screen to the Imperial March played by a flute choir. Most film composers, past and present, rely on a standard symphony orchestra with strings, woodwinds, blah, 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 right? But that was Herrmann's thing, was that he refused to be limited by one ensemble. So he used to put together really weird combinations of music. So instead of sticking to the script, at one point he would... in a film called Beneath the 12-Mile Reef, he used 9 harps. Now, get this. This is the orchestration for The Day the Earth Stood Still. Herrmann accumulated 3 electric string instruments, electric violin, electric cello, electric bass, 2 Hammond organs, an electric organ, 2 pianos, 1 celesta, 2 harps, 3 vibraphones, 2 glockenspiels, percussion, 1 horn, 3 trumpets, 3 trombones, 4 tubas, and to this he added 2 theremins.
Very good.
And that theremin, it was the first time, it's not the first time it's used in movie, but it was the first time they were really foregrounded.
Yeah.
and they became the soundtrack of spooky 50s space movies.
Wasn't Theremin... Theremin was Russian, right?
Yeah.
Wasn't Theremin involved in the Russian nuclear program as well?
I don't know, I didn't research that. But I think if it, it, the sound of the theremin across this, while you're reading this book...
Yep.
I was so hoping you would try and do a theremin impression.
I think I did better than try. I think I pulled it. I think I completely landed it.
Brother is watching you.
Ooh. Listeners, you are warned. This program is not to be listened to.
From where I stood, I could see them come in single file out of a side street into Shaftesbury Avenue and turn towards the circus.
I don't like this game.
The second man had his hands on the shoulders of the leader, the third on his, and so on, to the number of 25 or 30. At the conclusion of that song, somebody started, "Beer, beer, glorious beer," pitching it in such a high key that it petered out in confusion. They trudged steadily on until they reached the centre of the circus. Then the leader raised his voice. It was a considerable voice with parade ground quality. "Company, halt! Here we are, gents, one and all. Pick a bloody dilly circus, the centre of the world, the hub of the universe, where all the knobs had their wine, women and song."
Well, we are...
You enjoying the beer?
We are having some beer in Piccadilly Circus at the Glass Blower. And there's a few things that happen here, aren't there? There's the encounter with that group of people.
Beer, glorious beer.
Beer, glorious beer.
Well, the first thing that happens here is after he's seen this group in Piccadilly Circus, he's quite keen on a drink, this guy, Bill Mason, isn't he? Because he says, "Remembering that they had been headed for the Café Royal, I decided to revive myself and clear my head at the Regent Palace Hotel. Others appeared to have thought of that before me, but there were quite a lot of bottles they had not found."
Oh.
Now, the Regent Palace Hotel is... literally next door.
Literally next door to where we are now, indeed.
It's now the UGG boot store, which of course is the first place I'd smash a window.
Absolutely.
Well, there was social breakdown.
An epidemic.
If you didn't have a pair of UGG boots when the apocalypse came.
They're not tremendously good for walking, though, are they? They're good for comfort.
The Regent Palace Hotel, 10 Glasshouse Street, so we're right next door.
Yeah.
Between 1915 and 2006. The most interesting thing about it, I think, is that during the Battle of Britain in 1940, the Regent Palace was frequented by Canadian airmen who found it a good place to meet women.
Oh, really?
Since the Canadians had invaded London, the Regent Palace had become known as the Canadian Riding School.
Oh.
This sounds
wishful thinking on the part of somebody there.
Well, it's interesting that, that Bill Mason, obviously, he knows the area, and he decides that's a good drinking hole.
Which meant that John Wyndham knew the area.
Exactly. I think he did. So he cuts back to Regent Street higher up, and that's when he finds Gisela, I believe, close to Golden Square.
Oh, Golden Square's just around the corner from
here. Exactly. Just literally around the corner is Windmill Street.
Yeah.
Now, that's also... You know when we were saying that the Goon Show was the first...
Yeah, 1951.
1951 Goon Show. Well, we're in Goonland because they all met at the Wyndham Theatre.
Yeah.
Tony Hancock, Bruce Forsyth, Tommy Cooper, Barry Cryer all got early gigs at the Wyndham. Harry Secombe joined the bill in 1946. His act involved shaving while singing Italian opera. Didn't take much for insanity, though, did it? He met Michael Benteen and Peter Sellers there. With Spike Milligan, they would go on to create the Goon Show. They were all hanging out round the corner. So they would have been in this pub, almost certainly. So, Morecambe and Wise were sacked from the Windmill for being not funny. This is very much the cauldron.
And it's also interesting that this is where him and Gisela make their base.
Yes.
Well, you think they're based around
Well, there's they go into some clue, luxury apartments.
Well, they go into the, they go
Have
into
you found the reference?
There was, as I'd expected, no great difficulty about the flat. We left the car locked up in the middle of the road in front of an opulent-looking block and climbed it to the third story. Now, he doesn't actually say where the road is.
I think it's Regent Street.
But the clue later on is that obviously they see a light shining in the sky.
What he does is he puts a notch on the window ledge in line with where the light is coming from.
Yeah.
So that then in the morning he can work out what would be in line with the building.
A light there certainly was. I'm looking out of her window towards what I judge to be the northeast.
Yeah.
I could see a bright beam like that of a searchlight pointed unwaveringly upwards. So basically, he's southwest of the light.
Yeah.
Now, we know the light is at the Senate House. So it's southwest of the Senate House, which is exactly where this is.
This is basically here.
Yeah.
The most substantial buildings here are the ones on Regent Street, the massive terrace.
Well, Street,
on one side Swire is Street. The Piccadilly Hotel. It's now called The Dilly.
The Dilly, yeah.
And that did have private apartments.
And well, they say the third floor on here, don't they?
Yeah.
So they're not right at the
but
top.
But then on the other side is the similar building. It's a classic Regent Street look. So they've broken into a ritzy flat, I reckon.
In one of these blocks.
In one of these blocks. So just opposite us in the glass booths, there's a place called Venture House, which is a commercial building in Soho. It's basically... its entrance is Glasshouse Street, but you also get to it from 90 Regent Street. And it's straight into the top of there. And then you'd have a clear...
Well, if you come to the glass...
You'd have a pretty clear view across from the top.
If you come to the Glassblower pub, find the Glassblower pub, and then you're really right in the centre of all of it.
You're in the heart of Triffid darkness.
And they serve beer.
Beer, glorious beer.
Beer, glorious beer. Fill yourselves right up to here. Drink a good deal of it. Make a good meal of it. Stick to your old-fashioned beer. Don't be afraid of it. Drink till you're made of it.
So that's the end of part one of our Day of the Triffids adventure. Sadly, we have to leave the pub. And in part two, we'll be leaving the city and heading off out into the North Downs, or the South Downs,
South
the South
Downs.
Part of the North Downs. I get very confused.
It's the north face of the South Downs, West Sussex. If you'd like to get to the second episode immediately and listen to it right now, you need to subscribe to our Patreon page. Head over to patreon.com and search for Curiosity Specific, and you'll get all new episodes as soon as they're available.
We'll also share with you all our notes, web links, videos and photos and maps that we generate as part of making each podcast.
But I am looking forward to getting out of the city.
Why?
Well, just because it's nice to get a bit of fresh air.
But there's pubs here.
Yeah, it's full of Triffids though.
I don't care, there's pubs here.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.